Actually, that is pretty substantial. That's three of the six.
Yeah, three of the six. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to do a lot. We're 8 minutes in now. I don't know if we're going to do a lot better than what we got already. I mean, this call is supposed to be largely procedural, so I don't think we'll be making any decisions as to content. So,
Jordan, this is Steve. Do we have an agenda for this call?
We have a idea for the call, I don't think. Unless Jeff has been so polite as to create an agenda for us. I certainly did not do so.
Well, I wonder if one thing we should talk about is this public teleconference that I gather the GNSO Council asked the task forces to hold public teleconferences, and maybe we could talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, so if I were to think of a few things we might want to cover, I might throw out the just a general recap of the council call from Wednesday, including the action items that we were given, and then follow that on with a discussion of the sort of areas of interaction between the two task forces, and hopefully get to the point we have a third agenda item, which would be next steps for the two task forces. Because we do have some time now where we're supposed to be endeavoring to do more work prior to the end of the public comment period, of the new extended public comment period.
I think that sounds like a good idea.
Okay, great. Well, why don't you be the chair and do that then, Jeff?
Well, I can be the chair and delegate the first subject to you, since I missed the council call. I was at a doctor's appointment, so were you able to be on the call?
I was indeed, and I let me just pull up Bruce's email to make sure. Everyone's seen the email from Bruce, I presume, but a number of items were discussed, including the fact that at the time of the call there was very limited response to the call for public comments. It looks like, apparently Glenn just told me that there's been actually more comments over the past couple days, which is encouraging. But one sense of the council and various people raised it, and I think there was no real counter to it, and it was agreed to, was that perhaps passively asking for comments on the website was not sufficient in order to really get as enthusiastic and sort of nuanced response as we might like. So the council suggests, or commands, or I don't know exactly how to phrase it, but they have asked us to engage in at least two public teleconferences in order to get additional feedback from the community as to the suggestions of the various task forces. And I think those could be done either jointly between one or more of the task forces, or they could be done by individual task forces. And I think the idea is two or more teleconferences, whatever is deemed appropriate by the various task forces. I think there's a fairly broad mandate there for us to do what we need to, whatever we deem sufficient, as long as we have some. The next important item, obviously, is that the public comment was extended until July 5th, in conjunction with the request for the teleconferences. So that gives us a little bit more time. One thing to note, though, is that updated reports are due on July 12th, which is only a week after the close of the public comment period. So the idea was that there would be some additional discussion within the task forces, within or between the task forces, leading up to the revised close of the public comment period, and perhaps taking into account the comments received to date and on an ongoing basis. And then the second, the other point that, that Bruce made, obviously, is that the ideal is a 100% consensus for each of the task forces, as opposed to sort of majorities or even supermajority votes. And the task forces, including Task Force 1 and 2, should attempt, we should continue to attempt to coordinate our work so we don't have conflicting recommendations. So that's the brief summary. The action items for us are obviously to continue to work to have revised reports by July 12th and to make sure that we do have these public teleconferences in the meantime.
And after July 12th, what's the timeline from there?
And then it will be in the hands of the council, and I don't dare predict what the council might do at that point. But the most simple timeline from that point out would be that they would immediately see the brilliance of our reports and vote to accept them at the subsequent council meeting, which is... Glenn, help me out here.
That hasn't been arranged yet.
Sometime in the future.
Of having one before Kuala Lumpur.
Okay, so sometime. But it may be that if it's before Kuala Lumpur, it's before July 12th. Is that possible or no?
Isn't there some requirement in the PDP about how, or is there, I guess, a requirement about how long the report has to be given to the council before the council can act?
I think the only requirements that, I don't think there's any, Barbara can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think there's any specific requirement relating to the PDP. I think there's just the general intake requirement of the council.
Right, that's my understanding. The only requirements that are listed in the PDP have to do with the time period for the
I thought at one point...
What would the intake require?
I think it's 2 weeks right now.
Yeah, it's 14 days. So no earlier than July 20th. When is the council meeting in Kuala Lumpur?
The Kuala Lumpur meeting is, the council meeting is on the 20th of July in the afternoon at 2 o'clock local time.
Right, so technically they couldn't vote on it there. So it would probably be in August then.
I think there's an, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's another comment period after the final report is submitted.
Nope, there's not.
No, not in the PDP.
I would look at Section 9 of the PDP. Yeah.
All right, hang on.
Jeff is right.
Really?
I mean, that's the way it was supposed to be. You were supposed to get public comments, revise the report, put out a final report, get public comments again. This is,
Well, maybe not. Hold on.
Yeah, the way the PDP reads, the only thing that's supposed to happen after the public comment period is that the staff manager is supposed to gather up the public comments and put them in the report, basically. So
right,
I don't know what the function of a follow-on public comment period after that would be. Now, we're doing something not really in this... something a little bit different than what the PDP calls for in terms of what we're doing after the PDP. So arguably there may be some benefit to a follow-on public comment period, but it's not called for in the bylaws, I don't think.
So we're calling this one the final report?
Oh, it's called the final report, the very final report. There's nothing after the task force finishes the final report, it goes to council, and then council has a certain amount of time to consider, to do their deliberation, which I imagine will undergo the same process of extension that the rest of the whole thing has done for this particular issue. And then it says that if they so choose, they may solicit the opinions of outside advisors at that deliberation meeting or at its final meeting. and the opinions of these advisors, if relied upon, shall be embodied in the council's report.
I got you, yes.
But there's no additional public comment period unless it's included in actions of the council. Like if the council were to decide to make recommendations in a policy recommendation to the board, then they may choose to initiate a public comment period for those recommendations. But there's nothing mandated in the PDC.
So the council could hypothetically radically change everything, and there wouldn't be, and create a new set of recommendations, and there wouldn't be another public comment period?
Hypothetically, yes.
Hypothetically, I imagine that if such a thing were to take place, the ICANN board itself might institute a public comment period upon receipt of that recommendation. I can't imagine there wouldn't be another comment period.
Does the ICANN board have a required public comment period? I guess the answer is no. When it takes something up?
In certain circumstances, yes. And I just don't know this. I can't, like, decide ahead of time if it fits in those circumstances.
Thanks.
Okay, so to answer your question, Kathy, I think the earliest the council could probably vote would be in August, and the board could vote at the subsequent meeting of the board, which would be the fastest one. I think my guess is that the board might want to wait until they have a real meeting, so maybe Cape Town or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So just to nail this down, it's a matter of some consequence for us to understand, is the Kuala Lumpur meeting will not vote on these reports.
I think they will.
I think we won't hit the intake requirement. I mean, I guess it could go on the agenda in advance of our...
Yeah, I think, Gordon, there's a requirement to council vote on it within 100 days after receiving it. It's a requirement that the council call a meeting and vote on it.
Deliberate it within 10 days is their limit. But my understanding of how Bruce would like to proceed on this is that I think he wants to discuss it in KL, whether they're able to actually reach conclusions that become a policy document, I think dependent to a great deal on how coherent the overall material is. Like if there are clear recommendations from each of the task forces that fit together to create, meaningful policy recommendations, then I think they would be willing to move forward. I think if they have to do a lot of work to make that happen, then we're probably going to get a discussion in KL without voting in KL.
So just to, again, I have to be very unambiguous here. The reports are going to be discussed in Kuala Lumpur, but not formally voted on and passed up to the board.
Yeah, the PDP calls for them to deliberate the report within 10 days of receipt of the report. And so if we submit it on the 12th, then they should consider it, do some deliberation of the report by the 22nd. The 20th clearly fits within that guideline. My
20th fits, or because the 20th is not 10 days.
Within 10 days, it says.
Within 10 days. It doesn't say it has to be exactly 10 days. It just says within 10 days. By 10 days. And it says that they, and it says that they can commence deliberation prior to the formal meeting, so they can begin discussing it, on it through email and such.
But just to answer Milton, in theory, they could vote on it in KL.
Correct.
Wait, but there's a conflict. In one case, they need 2 weeks' notice on a document. In the other case, they have to act on something in 10 days.
I think they need weeks to put something on the agenda.
Right, so that just means that they're going to, Bruce needs to add it to the agenda at least 2 weeks in advance of the meeting.
But, you know, that does not mean you have to have a copy of the actual document in hand when
right.
it's put on the agenda.
So that means they could vote on it in KL.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yes.
It sounds like they could vote on it, and whether they will or not is not, it's beyond, it would be speculation at this point.
Does anybody want to write to Bruce and ask, if it wasn't mentioned in the council meeting, ask what he's thinking?
Well, I think there's a number of options that were discussed in the council meeting, and I don't think they know what they're in. I mean, it will depend on what the substance of the reports is. For example, the idea of forming an implementation committee to review the recommendations from a implementation perspective, as was done with some of the other previous task forces, is a real possibility, in which case the report wouldn't be accepted but would rather be handed off to an implementation committee. But if all the implementation issues have been dealt with by the task forces, then they may just accept them. I think it will be difficult for them to say what they're going to do with it without having seen the final reports.
Yeah. And actually, in reading the PDP, they if they fail to reach a supermajority vote, it appears they have to take some kind of vote. And if they fail to reach a supermajority vote, then it's almost like regardless of what the outcome of their deliberation is, the board report has to be created after that meeting, which discusses or deliberates their final report. And the board report either contains the recommendation of the council, or if there is no recommendation of council, it has to be the report has to be a discussion of what was deliberated and what were the different viewpoints and which constituencies expressed them and like that. So if there is no supermajority, then you're clearly not making a policy recommendation, but there still is a report that's generated for the board that sort of explains where things stand.
Okay. Any other questions on the council? I think we should work, just continue doing our work, and we'll see if we can get clarification from Bruce as to what he thinks the intent is and from the council.
This
would be
Steve
great.
Metallus. Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Did the council give any guidance on what they are looking for in these public teleconferences, or
Steve, they suggest a couple things. I don't know. I don't want to go so far as to say there were suggestions, but a couple of things were discussed in relationship to what was done with some of the previous task forces. One example of that is, now I don't remember whether it was the previous Who Is task force or transfers, but they had two conferences, one just for everyone that was interested that they published, and they also had one just for registries and registrars to discuss implementation issues. And so that was discussed as types of teleconferences that have been handled in the past, but I don't think there was any sort of mandate that we recreate those specific fora. So I think there's pretty broad discretion in the hands of the task forces to decide exactly how the teleconferences should be conducted, who should be invited to each one, and what the specific goal of each teleconference should be.
Invited? So we're talking about the invitation list for these task force teleconferences?
Some of them could be. For example, you might have one for registries and registrars to discuss implementation issues, and you might invite other people to those, but an implementation-oriented one might be by invitation, whereas you might have another one in which...
That's not what we're talking about now, because implementation assumes that you have a policy or a document that you're working from, and now you're talking about how to implement it. And what they're talking about, as I understood it, was having the existing task forces, which are supposed to develop a policy, have public teleconferences. Now, once those task forces are done with their work, I could understand having specialized implementation teleconferences. But to my mind, either, as I understand it, either these public teleconferences are simply a bad idea, or they're confused as to what they're supposed to be accomplished. So I can understand why Steve is asking what these conferences are supposed to do.
It's a shame that Marilyn's not on the call, because she was actually the chief proponent of this idea.
Surprise.
From what I understood her intention to be, she wanted people to have an opportunity to express their views in a format that might be, I don't know, more accommodating than email, easier for them to just raise issues in the context of the session.
Barbara, this is the kind of stuff that ICANN just has to stop doing. It's like, you have procedures, okay? You have a public comment period, you have a public comment website, you have a public comment procedure that has been fixed in advance, that everybody is playing by those rules, and now somebody says, oh, I just sort of don't like to do it that way. We business people prefer teleconferences because, we have paid-for phone lines, and we can all coordinate easily that way, and we prefer to talk rather than write email. And so you create a special new kind of comment period. Now, I don't care. If you had told us 6 weeks in advance we're going to accept public comments by means of teleconferences, I would accept it. But if you're saying, in the middle of the game you're going to change the rules and have
that's something you would have to take up with counsel. It's not actually a decision that was made by staff. It was a decision that was made through counsel.
I know. I'm expressing my opinion to
the
counsel and to any counsel members on this call that this is just a bad idea. We have a public comment procedure. Let's follow it. If you want to create special implementation committees after we have a policy, let's do that.
Nicholas here. Can I make a comment since I was on the GNSO call? As I understood, what the GNSO decided on was that basically, as you already know, it agreed to extend the public comment period, so on, that the updated report should be available on the 12th of July. But when it comes to the organization of more of public conference calls on the issue, it was only an encouragement to the task force to do so. If now the various members of the task force consider that it's not necessary, I don't think they would be in breach of a decision taken by the GNSO Council, because anyway the decision was only to encourage the task forces to do so.
Well, thanks for that clarification. That's a good.
Well, maybe what, this is Steve again, maybe what needs to happen is for each task force on, maybe online, to decide whether it wants to have a public teleconference, and if so, to schedule. I see Task Force 3 is already scheduled there, so they're doing it. But maybe for our task forces, we should decide whether we want to do it. I had my impression of this is kind of an open mic thing, and you would have the lines open for an hour, and anybody who wanted to come in and give their views would provide it. And I assume that a recording would be made, or that the staff would reduce this to writing in some way, and it would be an input to the report. But maybe that impression is incorrect. I'm just trying to figure out what this ought to be, and if in fact it's open to the task forces to say no thanks, we don't think we want to have one of these, then maybe each task force should just decide that.
I think that's a good idea to do it, to have the discussion online among the task forces.
Glenn, I know you combined the two task force lists together. So is any post made to any of the task force? Do they appear to both parties?
Normally they should appear because the task force one is on task force two, and task force two is on task force one. So if you get a mail sent to task force two, you should receive it as well.
Okay, so we'll discuss the issue within the task forces, but please only respond to your particular task force request. All right, Jordan, what was the next item?
In my proposed agenda was to talk about the two reports and the interactions between them.
All right, and for that, I saw you forwarded the Barbara's latest document.
Yeah, I apologize to everyone for just forwarding to the list so close to the call. Unfortunately, I don't know why. I thought Barbara had CC'd the list as well, and I noticed this morning that wasn't the case. So, sorry.
Well, this is Steve Patelis. Can I suggest one issue might be worth talking about a little bit? I noticed that Milton has made a posting to the Task Force 1 comment list with some corrections or clarifications of some of the Task Force 1 preliminary report, and particularly what was referred to in the Task Force 1 report as an individual list. He said wanted to correct that to an individual process. And, you know, we've obviously circulated, you know, we've encouraged people to look at the reports that were posted and so forth. But I wonder if Milton might want to walk us through what corrections he thinks are needed to the Task Force 1 report so we would have a better understanding of what really is being proposed there.
Sure. If I have the floor, I'll do that. What happened was that there was an agreement very late in the day of Task Force 1 to present these two policy options. And during that period, I submitted some language and then took an airplane. Was involved in a travel process from East Asia that literally consumed about 30 hours. So I wasn't able to see any of the subsequent modifications of the report. And Jeff, I think, tried to incorporate this one policy alternative into the report. There were just some conceptual, I think, misunderstandings or mislabeling that occurred. In particular, when we talked about the difference between a whitelist and an individual use authorization, the latter alternative did not involve any kind of a list. It involved an application process where you would submit, I want to get the sensitive data about person X, about domain name X. I am a certified, you know, identifiable user, and I am doing it for an approved purpose. And once that had been certified and the individual being investigated notified, then that person would get the data, and there's no construction of a list or any pre-approval process. So I think with just a few of those verbal modifications that I put in, that policy alternative would be described correctly. And again, the task force was not recommending that policy alternative over the other one. It was asking for comment on that vis-a-vis that in relation to the whitelist.
I think a lot of it was, I think that concept, Milton, is there. I think a lot of it was labels. And we did discuss this on a call that you weren't able to be on, and kind of got agreement within the group, but yeah, I think obviously you're correct in that we provided the options and we did not take a position on which option, if any, were going to be recommended.
This is Steve again, just to get a better sense of how this would work. So if I wanted access to the information on a particular domain name registration, I would present, here's what I understand you're suggesting. I would present to the registrar, I guess, who was sponsoring that registration, if it's in .com/.net and .org, I would present two things. One would be some type of certification or authentication of my identity, and the second would be a statement of what my purpose for the request was.
Right, selection from a multiple choice list, I think, is what we're talking about.
Okay, and then if my request had those two things in it, then what would happen?
Well, the first thing is, it's again not definitive whether you would submit that to a registrar. This is where implementation would needs to be discussed at some point. But your first part, which says you would submit it to a registrar, is not necessarily correct. It could be a centralized authority. There's different ways to implement it. But let's go in with your example.
Well, I just see Milton's posting said there wouldn't be a centralized administrative entity.
Right, and that's where, see, Task Force 1 has not had a chance to meet since Milton's comments.
Okay.
And so one of the things where I said we had a subsequent conversation while Milton was on the plane was some people had expressed a view that it would still be this centralized neutral authority that would say, okay, give the permission and give some sort of code or some way so that the registrar would be able to recognize that it is approved to go forward. That's one possible way. The other possible way is, as you described it, it's just anyone gets through. They just have to state the purpose, and the purpose has to be from a list, state who they are, and somehow authenticate that that's who they really are, and then give the one-time result. So there's different implementation mechanisms that have not been discussed.
Okay. All right. But in either case, assuming that my request had those two things in it, what would happen?
Would I
automatically get the data, or would somebody review that to see if they thought that I really was going to be using it for that purpose, or what?
They would get the data without any kind of authentication that that is truly your purpose. The way I understand it, and Milton jump in, they would get the data, and the identity of the registrant would be sent to the the identity of the requester would be sent to the registrant unless it falls within one of the exceptions which need to be defined.
That's how I understand it too. And then the any authentication or checking of abuse would then be up to the individual registrant.
Although presumably there's a list somewhere, and I know nobody's gotten this far, but there's a list somewhere of known abusers who get bounced. You know, people, for example, engaged in direct marketing.
Well, that's kind of where mine and Milton, that's why I always thought my thinking was that there would be this centralized neutral authority, receive all the requests and give out some sort of code to allow them to go forward so that they would know who was making their requests and that they could do a blacklist, I guess is what you're saying, something like that.
The registrars or the central authority?
What's that?
The registrars or the central authority would do the blacklist?
The central authority.
Okay.
But again, that's implementation that we just haven't gotten that detail. Our basic thing was we want to throw out these proposals for public comment and then get the task force back together and see what the results of the public comment were before making a recommendation.
Yeah.
Right, and I think to a certain extent, Task Force 2 took a similar tact in that we identified areas of where we thought there was agreement, and there was also, I think, a broad range of things on which we thought we needed more input on.
See, what I wanted to discuss at some point, a lot of Task Force 1, we basically said, look, we have our own ideas of what data we think should be sensitive versus non-sensitive. But in the end, we decided that that's really the job of Task Force 2, to say, okay, well, because that Task Force 1's whole point is if all you're displaying to the public, to the world, is non-sensitive data, and whatever that is, and we have our own ideas as what that is, but if that's all you're displaying, then all of these limitations, a white list or anything like that, it's not really necessary. There may be some things that registrars might want to do as far as limiting query volumes, things like that, or rate of queries to protect themselves, because even if there's only a little bit of information, it still could be of some value to someone and therefore susceptible to mining. But putting that aside, if it was just what we considered non-sensitive data, there wouldn't be any need for a whitelist or any of that. To the extent Task Force 2 decided that, no, some sensitive data should be displayed, then we would say, okay, well, this is the way you would access that sensitive data, through this whitelist or through this individual use or however we came up with it. So
so you guys have envisioned a two-tier system, to use the wrong word, where you either accessed all the data or the public had no access to the data except through some kind of form of subpoena.
When you say two-tiered, it was the tiers were you either access all of the non-sensitive data, which was pretty much available to anyone and weren't too concerned about that, or, yes, you could get all of the information that Task Force 2, you guys decided, was sensitive. And if you were to get that, these would be the terms and conditions of how you would get that and what you could do with the information.
So all or nothing?
No, it's not all or nothing. It's all or a subset of the information that is deemed to be non-sensitive information that they could sit in the public database and not be subject to marketing abuses or personal identification abuses.
So to go through an example, let's say, you know, Task Force 1 went through the exercise of what we thought was sensitive and non-sensitive and came to an agreement on some terms. For example, we all thought that the identity of the registrar, the name server information, that was non-sensitive. And if Task Force 2, if you guys said, well, that's the only information we want ever to be displayed to anyone, then we would say, okay, well, that we consider non-sensitive, so we're fine with it, and however you want to access it, whether port 43, web-based, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
If Task Force 2, you guys said, you know what, we think that certain people have rights to information about the admin contact. You know, in Task Force 1, we said, well, a lot of that is sensitive, and therefore, if Task Force 2 says that that is the type of information that should be made available to certain groups or to anyone, this is how Task Force 1 recommends accessing that information. And then we went and said, and then the rules of that, you know, not only of how you access the information, but then if someone's allowed to access it, then the registrant should be notified except under limited exception.
Yeah, so let me just jump in, this is Jordan, and add, you know, I think when we look at where some of the conflict and overlap between the two task forces came from, I think probably everyone would agree that deciding which information should be displayed under which circumstances or which sets of information should be displayed, you know, pretty clearly falls within the terms of reference of Task Force 2. The determination of the actual access mechanism, like what, you know, what protocols might be used or what, you know, specific methodologies are used to protect the information, I think, in my mind, pretty clearly fall within Task Force 1. And the problem is where we start to get into overlap is with people saying, I think there's a broad sentiment of people saying, well, I would be willing to make a piece of information X available to certain users, but only if X, Y, and Z happens in order to make sure that it's adequately protected. And so there we start to run into the ground where the mechanisms and the content start to overlap, I think.
I think that's exactly right.
Well, this is Steve Metallis. I would disagree with the statements about what was within the jurisdiction of Task Force 1, but I don't really think it's too productive to get into that. I'm just trying to understand a little better what the different, the two options were, and I think what Milton has said is very helpful in terms of understanding the individual use option. Now, the whitelist option, could someone, I'll give you my understanding of that, which would be that if I wanted access to this upper tier of data, whatever the sensitive data is, the way I would get it is that I would be, if you will, pre-qualified to do it by getting on a whitelist, which, and to get on that, it would require some type of authentication and I think some type of specification of purposes. But that once I had that credential, I could go to any registrar and get the data. Is that basically the whitelist proposal, or am I missing something?
I think that's part of it. Obviously, there are some rules as to what you could do with the data and some terms and conditions that would need to be followed. But basically, yes, if you being an individual company or whoever, didn't want to have to keep getting authenticated, or you wanted some sort of automated access, so you wanted to, it wouldn't be through a port 43, but it could be through another port or whatever else is developed in the future to do searches and other things, that you could have that authority to do that, but you would be subject to all the terms and conditions associated with that.
But presumably the same terms and conditions would apply in the individual use option, wouldn't they, or would they? I mean, wouldn't I have to agree in some way that if I had those two items and I went to the registrar or whoever to get access to the data, would I also have to agree to restrictions on use? They would probably be the same, wouldn't they?
Yeah, in most cases, yeah, it would be the same. It's just obviously much more susceptible to abuse with the whitelist than it is for an individual use list or individual use.
And the reason,
Steve, as I understand the crucial distinctions, is that the whitelist, number one, creates a categorical distinction between certain users and others, which the individual use process is designed to overcome so that everybody has the same rights. And secondly, the whitelist is, once you've been approved, as I understand it, you have access to anything and everything at all times, regardless of, you know, what your purpose is or what you're doing, whereas in the individual use, every time you access this sensitive data, you have to request it, and you have to go through the authentication, and you have to go through the notification.
Well, leaving the notification aside for a second, in terms of the purpose, what's the difference between saying, for example, in the whitelist model, if I said all the searches I'm going to, all the requests I'm going to make are for this purpose, what's the difference between that and in the individual use option, checking a box, you know, each time that says it's for this purpose?
From my point of view, the main difference is that it simply slows down the collection of data so that, you know, you really have to be concerned about a particular user or a domain name in order to go through the trouble of requesting it, whereas with the whitelist option, you can just say, hey, I wonder what's going on with this guy. I think I'll check him out. And in effect, it becomes not a way of protecting any legitimate rights you might have in the abuse of that domain name. It just becomes a surveillance mechanism that allows you free rein to access the data. And sure, you can say, you know, 6 months ago or 2 years ago, I'm only doing this for, let's say, checking up on IP violations. But in effect, you just have free rein to the data after you're on the white list.
But what would prevent me in that situation from, in the individual use option, from saying, hey, gee, I want to check this out? What would prevent me from just presenting the credential with those two, with that, presenting my authentication and then checking a box and getting it? I'm just not...
Well, the thing is, you just get one person. You get one, the record for one domain name.
Okay, and if you understand that.
You could lie about that, but presumably the registrant would be notified, and they...
Presumably you could lie in either case, but...
Yeah.
So the difference, as you said, it would be that it would slow it down, and you would only get one record at a time.
Wait, but let me add that the scope of abuse, based on this discussion, that the scope of abuse is dramatically limited in the individual use case, as opposed to once you've got unlimited access. And I'll also add that when people have to individually certify something, they think about it a little bit more. When I make my clients sign, each individual trademark application, I tell them to look at the paragraph and look really closely and read it each time. I don't send them a whole bunch of blank forms for trademark applications. I just tell them to sign and date it because I already know they're kind of operating the legal limits. I make them read it. And that's what individual certification does. It makes people think about what they're doing rather than just kind of signing a blanket statement once.
What would happen if I presented two copies of my authentication simultaneously and said, I would like to see this, the data for this registration and for this registration? Would I be shut out?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by simultaneity, and I think that gets into the details of implementation that we really haven't thought through yet, frankly.
I appreciate that. This, I think, this helps understand helps me to understand better what the differences are between these two. And as far as notification to the registrant, that presumably could be handled the same way under either one, couldn't it?
Yes.
Yes, I guess.
The only difference theoretically would be that in the individual use case, the registrant could also be notified about the intended use, whereas with whitelist, they wouldn't know what the use.
Well, I think in general, it was my understanding that for the whitelist, they would still say, we are this entity, this is what we do, and this is the purpose for which we are seeking entry onto this whitelist. And then I could be that the registrant is notified of that general purpose that entity is on the whitelist.
Right. So I guess that implies then that you can't be on the whitelist to do more than one thing.
No, that's the problem. If you're on the whitelist, they're probably going to check every, box, and the registrant will get a list of all the general purposes for which you could access the data.
So you can't check more than one box on the individual use option.
Again, that's
I mean, that would be our philosophy, but
that's implementation details that we haven't got into. I mean, that's...
But in principle, if you see this domain name is associated, let's say, with a site where illegal software is being downloaded, you should know why you're getting that domain name information. It's not like it's just, this domain name looks funny to me. It could be that I want to buy it. It could be that I want to check out trademark infringement. It could be that I want to check out copyright infringement. I mean, you've got to know why you want the information for that particular domain name.
The general principle is in our report, and the general principle is that to the extent that sensitive data is displayed, the requester needs to identify themselves, and the registrant needs to be notified of who is seeking that information and the purpose for which they are seeking the information. That's a general principle that we cite for everything. And there are some exceptions, and that needs to be clarified. But so that general principle applies to whatever mechanism, individual use, whitelist, or maybe there's even another option out there, but the principle is the same.
I think both task forces have the same principle, don't we? Same principle.
Well, the notification principle, I think, is a question for task force 2, whereas it's a principle in task force 1.
If I could just finish up on this topic. As I understand it, the .name system is really pretty close to what you're talking about for the whitelist system, right? Because there you go once, you specify a purpose. I think you may be able to specify more than one purpose, I'm not sure, from a list, and then you get a password. Now, that's a particular implementation, but you get a password, and that gives you access to the data for some, you know, however many requests you make for some period of time. On notification, there's not an automatic notification to the registrant. There is preservation of an audit trail so that if there are instances of abuse, it can be demonstrated who got access to that data. That's kind of the whitelist system, isn't it?
Except for that last part. I think even with the whitelist, the registrant would be notified.
I understand. Okay.
Right. So aside from that, it's similar, although it's hard to say because I don't believe .name's ever really implemented it.
No, I agree. They haven't. Just in terms of what it looks like on paper, it looks like this whitelist system.
Does anyone know why they've never implemented it?
No, but we could ask them.
I would assume from being a registry that it's not exactly an inexpensive thing to implement. So, I don't know. We should ask. That should be a question we ask them.
Because we know they've been contacted by the UK Data Protection Commissioner. And is it possible that in conjunction with that, they've been held up?
I don't know.
I think the answer is we just don't know.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the reports?
Yeah, this is Kathy. I wanted to double check. It doesn't, as I reviewed the sensitive and non-sensitive data from Task Force 1's report, and the recommendations, particularly from Section 3.5, publication of data from Task Force 2's report, I want to double check. I get the feeling we're closer than I had, you know, that we're pretty close here, where that we're using different terminology, but fundamentally, we're pretty close, and I just want to run it by the group, closer than I thought, kind of based on my discussions with people before the report. We have Task Force 1, and Jeff, your summary recently, that if it's non-sensitive data, here's the list, and we don't think that there's much of a problem putting this out, publicly available, anonymously available. The recommendation 6.5A, details about the domain name should continue to be displayed to the public, I think it's missing an and, on an anonymous basis. Our technical and operational details, what we're calling technical and operational details, I think are the same as your non-sensitive data details, except, we're more inclusive of the kinds of things that you're not including here.
www.freeconference.com. www.freeconference.com. You can then... Callers are already in the conference. Please announce yourself.
Appropriate to put out into the anonymous access. But we were playing with that. And then we continue. Further contact details for the registrant administrative contact would be available in one or more protected tiers. So I don't see the task force as being that far away.
No, I think to thank them, you would just say, if further information were to be provided, it would be done so in the mechanism set forth by Task Force 1, or in the mechanisms discussed for sensitive data by Task Force 1, and then it would just stop there, rather than trying to specify anything, any other conditions. That's how you would, in theory, sync the reports.
Right. Yeah. I think if we were willing to draw a line in the sand and say that people in Task Force 2 are willing to say, well, we're just going to specify which data is displayed always, which is displayed sometimes, and which is displayed never, then you know we would at least have a clear that's a possible line of delineation, I suppose. And then Task Force 1 is responsible entirely for determining the circumstances and conditions under which the sometimes happen. My suspicion is it will be hard to get people to agree to what should go in sometimes without knowing how it's going to be disclosed and under what circumstances.
Right. But I guess now you have that understanding as to what we're suggesting. You know the terms and conditions as to if you deem certain information to be non-sensitive, or you guys call it what, technical and operational, that information is, we would advocate, if that was the only information displayed, that it wouldn't really need to be any limits
to that, right?
Any whitelist training. But if you deem, but all other information, if it's disclosed, you know, we say that you could say that it can be disclosed in the methods that Task Force 1 deems appropriate for sensitive data. And then that would be, that's where the clear delineation is. It's kind of a leap of faith, because Task Force 1 is taking a leap of faith that that Task Force 2 is deciding which data is correctly sensitive versus non-sensitive. And Task Force 2 is taking the leap of faith that Task Force 1 determining the best way to make such sensitive data available. So that's kind of almost like a leap of faith if the task don't have a joint report.
Yeah, well, let me just thinking about this from the perspective of trying to get something done, based on the types of conversations that we've had within our task force and the where we've been able to move to compromises between sometimes very high opposed positions in terms of what data should be displayed or not, I think the only way to get those compromises is when there's an understanding of the circumstances under which the data is disclosed. I don't think it would be possible for us to do our work under the circumstances in which we don't know. I mean, just as an example, you know, people might be perfectly happy to have all of the information currently and who is displayed if the mechanism for gaining access to it was to bring a subpoena to the registrar's, office. But that doesn't mean that they're equally happy having all that information disclosed if the mechanism for gaining access is typing in, you know, like a automated Turing test type thing where you see a graphic and type in the letters. So I can't imagine that it's going to be possible to draw that particular bright line and have the two task forces operate sort of independent of each other without some level of interaction between the circumstances under which the information is disclosed.
Yeah, and that's why I kind of trying to advocate since the beginning a combination of the task forces, because I think it's the same thing for Task Force 1. You know, we kept talking around and around as to what data is going to be made available, and that completely determines what method of access we would be advocating. So it is a complete dependency upon each other, and which is why I don't think it at this point makes sense to operate independently. It's just because we can't have two reports saying two different things. So you might as well have one report that joins the work of the two task forces together.
Sure. Jeff, other than the tiered access portion of your proposal, do you have other recommendations that are suggested within your report?
There was, before the recommendations, and I know this is just stuff in your intro, you guys go into a little bit of detail as to the needs and justifications for WHOIS information, which I think in some respects do conflict with ours. Because we actually, our mandate was to talk about the needs and justifications, and we did a survey and collected all of it. And we didn't just take things at face value, whereas it seemed like in Task Force 2, you guys just put whatever was in people's statements as to how they use it and didn't really question it. You just kind of put that in as your introduction. Whereas, and I need to find a specific example, and Milton may be better at this, finding the example, but we actually questioned whether people really needed things for certain purposes. I think one of them was ISPs saying that they needed WHOIS information to prevent denial of service attacks, I think is something. That was in the ISP statement. You guys just took that from the ISP statement and put it in your report, whereas we questioned it and said we really need more details in order to say that is truly a need for WHOIS information. So with that respect, I would ask that if we do have two separate reports, that you guys kind of eliminate that from your report, since that was one of our things in our mandate, is to look at the needs and justifications. To certainly provide us comments where you think we haven't included things or we misstated things.
Jeff, I think you're referring to footnote 13 of your report, which doesn't say don't think that's right. You just say
questioned it.
Set forth exactly how WHOIS information is used to prevent these attacks.
Right, so we question.
Task Force 1 seeks comment from those individuals responsible for network security.
That's correct.
WHOIS information prevents denial of service attacks.
Right, which is the way, why if we say we questioned it, whereas you guys just assumed that to be true.
We assume that people said what they used the data for, they knew what they were talking about, but you
actually
lying, right?
Actually, Steve, it was pretty clear from our conversations that the persons making that claim did not know what they were talking about, because and we were being very polite by merely questioning it, because it was pointed out by somebody, I think by Jordan, by Paul Sahura, that to combat a denial of service attack, you're talking more about IP addresses, and that domain name related information is absolutely useless in most cases. And the ISP representative on our task force could not, in fact, defend that assertion and said he would get back to try to find out what the justification was and never submitted anything.
Right.
So I thought that was a very, very nice way to handle it, but in fact, I think it was a claim that was made, and claims are made that have no basis.
But I think the main point of that is that we looked into it and kind of questioned things, and I see a conflict there. Even though you just in your introduction, I see a conflict because we spent a lot of time looking into the reasons and justifications and talking about it. So I would ask that if we don't combine the reports, that would be eliminated from yours and just left with ours. As far as the recommendations that we have.
I would certainly oppose that.
Yeah, Jeff, let me just ask that we'll add that one of our milestones is to conduct an analysis of the existing uses of the registrant data element. So I don't think it's something that, you know, we just, you may be looking at needs and justifications, whereas we're looking at uses. and that may be a relatively minor distinction, but I don't think it's a topic. I don't think we'd be filling our terms of reference to simply eliminate that portion of the report.
I think, again, it's another reason that we should probably be combined. I can't question what's in your terms of reference. I think it's kind of ridiculous that they put those terms of reference, those two different things, because obviously needs and justification looks at how people use it.
Is anyone else getting a lot of echo in?
Yes.
Yeah, over the past few minutes.
Yeah, so kind of frustrating, I guess, because I guess what we would say is, we would ask is, how much did you really look into Ben's uses, or did you just accept people's word for it and put it in?
By and large, I think we did just accept people's explanation. None of them struck me personally as seeming particularly outrageous claims as to how they might possibly use the WHOIS. Just thinking of the particular example you're citing, I certainly can think of times in the past when I worked for an ISP that I used WHOIS information in order to respond to various types of anomalous activity, including various attacks.
Jordan, are you talking about IP address WHOIS, or are you talking about DNS WHOIS?
I'm talking about both. Often the IP address WHOIS will point to an entity, and the contact information there might be stale, so then you might use the WHOIS for the domain associated with the entity to find a contact that might work.
Let me ask a question. Does anyone see, I haven't really talked about, would there be a problem in combining the report?
Well, Jeff, let me just make that a slightly more nuanced question by saying I was thinking that things that we might do, I think there's definitely, it will be difficult to resolve the issues with regards to tier access. So one approach we could take would be to have joint recommendations or a joint section of the report with regards to the tiered access points, and then also have the two independent reports as well, or we could just merge the whole thing.
Yeah, I think once you take tiered access out of one, there's not much of anything else.
Yeah, well, we have several other recommendations, I guess. So I would view our report as having a fair bit of meat regardless of the tiered access proposal. I do think it's an important one. But if you guys are, depending on how the merge takes place, as long as none of those recommendations are lost, I think it's perhaps acceptable.
I think most of our, and Barbara, maybe I'm misreading, most of our recommendations are lead-ups to the tiered access. So it's principles that you should follow, and then this is how you would implement it. If you take that out, all joint recommendations, then there's not much. I can't think of anything that's really just Task Force 1 other than our needs specifications analysis, which I'd hate to have conflict with yours as far as uses. It makes sense to combine that, too.
I think that's a fair assessment of CF1's report. I think that there are probably some...
I'm sorry, the echo is so bad, I cannot understand what Barbara is saying.
Could everybody mute? Because I missed going back to Jeff's question.
Okay, did that improve things?
No.
No.
Not really.
You are now muted.
Then I think we might have reached the stalemate in the discussion at the moment.
So now the echo's gone, I think.
Oh,
thanks, someone.
Interesting. What I was saying is that I think that what Jeff was saying about the report was probably pretty accurate in terms of the implications for merging the two reports. I think there are some differences in how you both approach the discussion of certain issues, and that's been revealed in your discussion today. And I think that there probably are some concrete disagreements among you about including certain information versus other information. But I think that, on the whole, there's quite a bit of room for accommodating that in a combined report. And I certainly think it would make it a better presentation to the council in terms of helping them move forward with policy recommendations.
My concern with that is simply that the time required is not fitting within this July 12th submission. If you're going to bring the task force together to combine a report, you're going to be dealing with lots of discussions simply about the editorial practice, also not to mention the difficult trade-off policy questions. So you're pushing back the good by at least a month.
I would dispute whether it be a month. I think that, in fact, if Jordan and Jeff and I made a concerted effort, we could probably have a draft before the joint group, you know, within a fairly short amount of time. The question of whether that got bogged down in a line-by-line discussion of the merits of each statement, that could easily extend to a month and is not a prospect I look forward to. So if what people feel is that it would take that kind of scrutiny to achieve a joint report, then it probably isn't worth the effort. If it could be done without that level of you know, wordsmithing, then I think it probably is worth the effort.
So Barbara, what you're saying is that we really don't care that much the details of this to get it done fast, but we want to make sure that the final reflects the views of our constituencies.
I think I'm saying something different than that, but I think that if that's the concept that people have of it, that it would require that kind of arguing line by line about what to be included and what not to be included, then I think it isn't worth the effort. We've gone through that already with the individual task forces, and it's, you know, if that's the prospect of doing it as a joint task force, then I don't think it's the effort.
Yeah, I mean, even in theory, it seems that the constituencies' views have been, hopefully, if this process has gone well, represented in both Task Force 1 and Task Force 2's report, yet somehow we've ended up with somewhat different results, despite taking the viewpoint of various constituencies into consideration. So I don't think, you know, in the process of merging the two, we get yet another prism, I guess, that's going to reflect various constituencies to be used somewhat differently, but it's not like we're going to pool. I don't think we'd be in a position where we would simply be saying, oh, well, we're going to disregard the viewpoints of constituencies as a result of this, but rather we would say that in some cases the way viewpoints were reflected in Task Force 1 or Task Force 2 would have to be somehow incorporated. And I think further that the task forces would have, the constituencies would have a chance to provide further feedback, you know, as the merging takes place. But I agree that it could be I would be surprised if we were able to meet our July 12th deadline. I'm not sure, Milton, it's another month, but it's certainly, you know, 3 weeks is probably not enough time for us to do that.
I think what needs to happen is that some ground rules probably need to be set, obviously in combination. We don't want to reopen everything that was done. What we want to do is figure out ways to merge the two thoughts together. So,
but I think the reason there's kind of a logical contradiction here. On the one hand, you're saying there are somewhat serious differences of perspective in these two task forces, and therefore these issues sort of have to be hashed out. On the other hand, you're saying this is just kind of an editorial thing, that we throw the two things together editorially, and that makes it easier for the council to read it.
No, I think when Kathy was going through some of the summaries that she was going through, we are close on a lot of areas. I'm not saying that there's severe conflict. I'm saying that there are conflicts, and where those conflicts exist, that's where we need to hash it out. Where there's no conflict, then it's just, as you said, kind of an editorial combination. But we wouldn't want to reopen things. Like, for example, Task Force 2 has a whole bunch of stuff on privacy laws in countries. Task Force, it's not the role of Task Force 1, if we combine the two, to question that now. That is pretty much should be untouchable by the people in former Task Force 1. So that's the kind of ground rules I'm setting.
Mm-hmm.
What about focusing, am I off mute? This is Kathy.
Yes.
What about focusing on I don't know, findings, recommendations, that kind of area, so specific parts of the report? Because I think there's a lot of background material where we do come in with different perspectives, and there might be a way, again, if time is of the essence, there might be a way to include our different perspectives, but it's the recommendations that are really going to, it's the specific findings and then recommendations that are really going to take us forward. Is it possible to work on merging those areas and then maybe even let each task force decide kind of their own introduction to the report, to the joint report?
Mm-hmm.
Or stick with the wording that they've already got so that, I can see the importance of trying to merge everything, but given time, recommendations.
In the interest of trying to, because I know we all have to go, at least I do anyway, and we're getting towards the end of the time. Barbara Jordan, would it help if we tried to put down some sort of draft?
Yeah, I think what I was going to suggest, and I think it probably comes out pretty similar to you, is that we, the three of us, do sit down together and put together something for discussion to see, and maybe that discussion is where we think that it is just editorial, actually put together those portions of the document, which may be, combining like the sort of background bits in a way, and then where there's recommendations that there's no conflict, also include those. And then the rest, where there are conflicts and recommendations or we do perceive some tension between the reports, to just highlight those areas and say these are the areas that we're now going to have continued discussions about in the joint task forces, and maybe meet again next week to see whether or not we think those areas are too daunting to tackle in the next few weeks or not.
Well, I hope this doesn't sound crabby, but I would agree with that in principle as a way of going forward. The problem is that sort of what we agreed to do in the last conference call 10 days ago, in which you, the chairs, were supposed to come up with a list of areas where the task force conflicted. And then we never got this. Apparently something was sent the day before this call or a few hours before this call. And if that's the procedure we're going to follow, I'm concerned about it, because we simply have to be able to read this report and find out whether things that we really value haven't been lost or things that we don't want in there haven't been added in.
Yeah, I agree, Milton. That's a legitimate concern. Having said that, we had two phases of the document. I think one was widely distributed to the list over a week back, and that was a lighter weight version than the full scale analysis that was distributed to the list today. Unfortunately, that was fairly late.
Jordan, can I suggest this? I think the kind of document you're talking about would be very helpful. Let me suggest that you, Jeff, and Bart work on that and distribute it, and that we reconvene at least three business days following the time that you distribute it. That'll
give
us time to look at it.
Yeah, that seems like a reasonable approach, Steve.
I mean, I think that's good. Jordan, I have to drop off, so I'll call you later.
Yeah, and I have to drop off within the next 3 minutes. So, Jeff, why don't you go ahead and drop off, and I'll wrap up.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. Does anyone else other than that, does anyone else have any final topics or thoughts they want to discuss or have us explore between now and the next call, which will be three-ish business days after the publication of this document? Great. Okay, so Barbara and Jeff and I will endeavor to get this report, the consolidated document, put out, and hopefully that will happen in the near future, and then we'll have a call shortly after that to discuss what we think we can do with it.
Okay.
Great.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay, bye.
Bye.